Welcome back to Word and Table, a bi-weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I'm here, as usual, with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Good to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the Director of Formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement, and he is the Canon Theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America. Today, Father Stephen, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Gospels, and specifically something that was always curious to me. So when I read sort of, you know, modern literature, and I try a bit of fiction writing myself, and it always comes down to there's the story you want to tell, but then there's a lot of details that you furnish it with. And one of the things that always struck me about reading the Gospels is how the details are very, very different. They're not the details that I think a lot of other modern, you know, say novelists or history writers would have picked. For instance, there's not a whole lot of physical descriptions of things. Mm-hmm. Instead, the Gospels tend to opt for other details, locations, how people react to things that Jesus did. You know, there's never a physical description of Jesus, what he looks like, or whether, you know, it was a hot day on the Sea of Galilee, and the birds were trilling in the trees or whatever. And it's just very clear that the gospel writers are picking very different details to put into their narratives. And I just wanted to ask you, is there some reason for this, or some kind of guiding principle that guided the gospel writers to choose the details they chose to tell the story of Jesus with?
Well, Alex, that's a very sound observation. Let's put it this way. The evangelists are no Charles Dickens. I mean...
Yeah. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Right. We're not going to get all sorts of colorful scenes. However, the details, that tells you there are a lot of details, but they play a very different role in the scriptures. They're not meant there to create a mood or atmosphere. They're almost always a clue to something else. Actually, something that can really help us is being aware that details we might, since we grew up reading things where details often are just divine to give you a context, you know, a colorful context, you know, sort of an image, actually have a role to play in the Gospels that we could read them more carefully. So I suggest, for example, when we look at details, they help us to understand the text. I could think of like three categories, roughly speaking, of details. Not exhaustive, but I think, first of all, they're the reaction shots of those who are present. You know, this is interesting when you do movies and things. When you take a course like on movies, they'll tell you, like with a comedy or something, is what's funny isn't nearly so much as someone saying what is funny, but you see a reaction. Somebody else, you know, with a strange, oh, wow, did they say that?
Right. It's like a laugh track.
Right. Or like music at a movie to tell us, were they serious? Is this meant to be a funny moment, a deep moment? We have to get some clue. How should I understand this? Is this meant to be serious? Is it meant to be deep? Is it, you know, and we get clues how to do this. And often the details of the reactions, you know, on a miracle or a teaching, are designed to tell us, yeah, here's how you should understand it this way. It's like that background music telling us, yes, this is the real point.
Okay.
Another thing is they sometimes add details that add credibility. Is, you know, you wonder, well, gee, is this, you know, they'll get something and think, wow, I can just tell this is, you know, it's very authentic, something that, wow, this is authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing is, the authors just figure out, we are so used to the Gospels, but people hearing the Gospel for the first time, there are questions that would naturally come up, and sometimes we're getting ahead of our questions.
Okay.
Saying, I know you'd wonder about this. I'm going to get it right off of the bat here. I'm going to tell you something that's going to get rid of that question right now.
So certain details are included in certain stories sometimes in order to anticipate an objection that someone,
exactly,
a common objection that someone of the time might have had to.
Exactly.
Okay, fascinating.
A logical one anyone would have if they think about it.
Yeah. Okay, so how do these details help us to understand the text?
Well, maybe we could walk through some examples for like the reaction shots, I like to call them there. They're basically two functions. One is that they can provide a context for interpreting, and also they sometimes can raise the questions we would ask. Did I hear that right?
Okay, interesting.
Is that what you're saying? Is this meant to be a hyperbole? Are you serious about this? Here's a great example, the rich young man. Jesus says something. He says, in Mark's version, for example, he says, how difficult it will be for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God. Then he says, like going through a camel going through the eye of a needle. Now, that's literally impossible. He sees hyperbolic. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, what does he really mean? How serious is he about this? Is this just hyperbole, or is he serious?
Mm-hmm.
And so what do they say? It says they were exceedingly astonished and said, then who can be saved? They're telling us, no, we heard him right. Because Jesus doesn't correct them. He said, with man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. He's saying, no, you are hearing me right. I'm serious.
Okay, interesting.
So we might have thought, well, no, it's just a poetic way of saying this. But, you know, their reaction tells us they're getting the reaction we might have. Do you really mean this?
Right.
Then
right.
Who could be saved?
And so if they're astonished by this, then we should also be astonished right. by this. We shouldn't treat this as just some kind of clever, you know, like Confucian axiom or something like that. Like this
we should realize
really...
it's meant to be taken pretty seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
Another example, like with divorce, that teaching, we've talked about that in a different context. That's a pretty shocking thing. He says, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality, marries another, commits adultery. Now, what's the reaction? The idea of getting married knowing you can't divorce. They say with someone in the 21st century would say, if such is the case of a man with his wife, better not to marry.
Huh, okay, yeah.
So the and what's going to happen here is instead of saying, oh, no, I didn't mean that, guys, I'm talking this isn't ideal, he yeah. doesn't correct them. So
he doesn't wink.
He doesn't wink and nod, say, no, this is an ideal. You know, he says, no, I mean it. You know, but he doesn't correct them. So they're putting up saying, otherwise we might be tempted to say, well, this is an ideal, but of course we're going to have, it won't always be that way. They say, well, if this were really true, then you wouldn't even get, a man would never get married. And he doesn't correct them. He goes on, they're saying this is serious.
Yeah.
It really would make you think more than once about marriage. It's wow. not a casual thing.
You know, one of the things that reaction shot makes me think of is you talked about cinema earlier, but did you ever seen the movie Jurassic Park?
Yes.
The Steven Spielberg movie? You know, the first moment that all the characters see the dinosaurs, this huge dinosaur, before you even see it, you see any of the special effects, it's like a full minute of every character jaw dropping and them, like, mm-hmm. pulling off their glasses and... It does all of the heavy lifting in the scene. Like,
yes.
You know that this is amazing before you even see the amazing thing. So is that something kind of like what's going on in the
Exactly.
Gospels?
It's creating, yeah. again, how would we, it's vital to understand in each of those cases, we might be tempted to say, well, this is just hyperbole. The fact that they raise that and Jesus doesn't, no.
yeah, yeah.
Tells us, no, he's serious about this.
Okay.
That's a very vital way to understand.
So be astonished.
Be astonished. Yeah. That is the intent. You're not misreading this. With Jairus' daughters, another interesting case. Because it says they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. This is where he raises this girl who is dead. And Jesus saw commotion. People were weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead but sleeping. Okay, so Jesus says, oh, no, the child's not dead. Now, there's a lot of people. What do? Their reaction is they laughed at him. That's a really important reaction because if you think about it, people don't raise the dead. Yeah, curing people is one thing, but that's really a whole different class of things,
mm-hmm.
raising the dead. So the first thought you might have would be, well, maybe she wasn't really dead. Maybe she just passed out, was in a coma, you had very low breathing, and, you know, he came through. And that's what it is. Maybe it wasn't really death, appearance of death, near-death experience.
Yeah.
Now, the house being full of professional mourners, these are people who knew their way around dead people, who had all seen you say, she's dead.
Yeah.
Helps make us avoid that. It wasn't just the parent thinking, I think my daughter's dead. And he goes up, oh, actually, you know, it's just low breathing. You know, we know for a fact, it really reinforces for the fact, because it's very, it's a huge miracle. Raising the dead is a whole different class of miracles. But they're saying, no, she's really dead. That's why they laughed at him. It wasn't like, you mean she's still alive? Doubts.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's, oh, come on.
Yeah.
She's dead. We know dead people. Okay, so that's really a valuable piece of information. The paralytic is interesting there. Remember the paralytic they let down through the roof? And Jesus says, your sins are forgiven. And they say, they say in their minds, we're told that, you know, that literally, who can forgive sins but God alone? That's the point. It's not who can forgive sins. But they add, only God could do that. So that helps us draw the conclusion. We have proof that Jesus can forgive sins. Jesus tells us in that story,
mm-hmm.
The fact that I can raise him up shows you I have this power.
Yeah.
So he proves he has the power. But they say, wait a second. Yeah, if you have the power, but that power belongs to God, therefore you must be.
Yeah.
So it brings us, it's not just that, isn't that neat that God let him do that? is, wait, right. This is a unique power to God. God lets people heal, but only God can forgive sins.
So in the so in this case, the reaction shot is people making the connection that where the readers are supposed to make. That
yes,
this
and Jesus doesn't correct them.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't say, oh, no, I have the special authority from God. He doesn't correct them.
Sure.
He says that you may know the Son of Man has the power
right.
to forgive sins. Rise, take up your pallet, walk.
He doesn't correct them like, who is it, Peter in the book of Acts, who corrects people who are trying to worship
right.
him. Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, there's a lot in that.
He buys that argument. Yeah. He's saying, that's the correct argument.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say? Well, you said, you know, who can forgive sins but God? I can prove I can forgive sins, so what's the conclusion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The storm on the lake is one thing that we might miss that's obvious to in the Old Testament. If you read the book of Psalms a lot, there are endless Psalms that have lines like this. Who stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves? You rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you're still there. Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty. You know, it goes on. I mean, the right. book of Psalms. One of the classic things about God is he has this unique power over the elements. That's a classic power of the God of the Hebrew Scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
He alone has this. He has the power, you know, to still the storm, etc.
Yeah.
And here we have, and when Jesus has the storm on the lake, he says, "Peace, be still." Their reaction is, "Who then is this that even the wind and sea obey him?" Now Jesus has been casting out demons and things. That's one thing, because there have been exorcists and things, but only God is ever recorded in scriptures of actually, you know, stopping a storm.
Okay.
You know, we have Elijah prayed for rain, uh-huh. You know, but the point is only God could stop the storms and bring still.
Right.
And so he says, who is this that could do something like that? Again, inviting our conclusion. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this, yeah, this
it's
is
it's more
God.
Than just, isn't this neat? He could stop the storm. This is a different type of miracle than healing somebody.
So in this case, you know, I can see now how describing what it must have looked or felt like to have the storm stopped around you, the experience of it is kind of beside the point of what the gospel writer is trying to say. You know, this is God.
Exactly. It's yeah. sort of what happens in John's gospel with the miracle of Cana. Here's the point that he makes. I don't know if we've ever talked about that. Remember, he comes at first. And Mary comes to him and says, describes simply as the mother of Jesus, comes to Jesus and says, "You're running out of wine." He says, what's that to me?
Mm-hmm.
My hour hasn't come.
Right.
But then he goes around and does it. Why does he do it? Well, some people say Mary talked him into it. I think what the text is actually doing there is it's pointing out we might get the wrong idea if he just said, okay, that he used his divine powers to solve regular human practical problems.
Uh-huh.
Frankly, like a keg run,
mm-hmm.
you know. and it's not like that. So the basic point he's telling her, I'm not solving this problem. I'm going to do something, but it's not about that problem. That's not why mm-hmm. it's going to happen. And notice the conclusion at the end in John is this first miracle, Jesus manifested himself and his disciples believed in him.
Okay.
So the point wasn't the water turning to wine. It was the fact that he could do it. So the miracle isn't the water to wine. The thing we should be focused on is who could do this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we don't get misfocused on, isn't this neat that maybe we could do this elsewhere. No,
okay.
It's imagine a person who can do that. It's focused. Jesus should be the focus of this.
So there's a different focus to the gospel.
The focus of the miracles is their signs. They tell us something about Jesus.
Yeah.
It's not the thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's like later on he says, you're only asking for bread because you want free lunch.
Right.
He said, I'm talking about bread from heaven. I mean, I'm talking, this is only a sign of something much bigger.
So you talked earlier about people's reaction shots can certainly, you know, tell us how we're supposed to be experiencing what's happening. But you also talked also about details in the Gospels that add credibility to certain
things. Oh, yeah, there's some here. One I love, for example, often gets criticism for people saying women are being put upon or something, is when Peter's mother-in-law is healed by Jesus.
Uh-huh.
The Gospels say she got up and served them and say, isn't that like a bunch of men to ask her, this poor sick woman, to get up?
Yeah,
but the missing thing here is, first of all, in the ancient world, serving dinner was a big deal physically.
Mm.
It wasn't like now pulling things out of the microwave or whatever.
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
You had to be pretty spry.
But here's the point. Think about anyone who's seen faith healers on TV or something. One of the things that was some, when they're not on the up and up is, you know, sometimes people say, well, gee, they have someone with crutches. I feel better.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And the point is, we might say, well, that's just a momentary thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just why maybe they genuinely, you know, think that, but they're just a delusion. Really, it's just going to come back.
Uh-huh.
And that's why in Acts of the Apostles, the cripple who is suddenly healed, you know, says, goes about dancing, leaping, and praising God. You know, showing this was not an illusion like, oh, I think I can stand. No, he's more than that. He's obviously healed.
Yeah.
So in the case of Peter's mother-in-law, is what's happening here. It's not like she says, yeah, I feel better. Thank you. My head doesn't hurt. My stomach's better. No, it was she actually gets up and actually is fully active. That's a big deal to put on a meal. She does it. It's the proof that she's healed.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we might think, yeah, he says that, but how do we know that she's really healed? She just, maybe she thought she was.
Okay.
Felt a little better.
Let me point out another detail to you. There are a couple of moments in the Gospels, and it's super confusing to me, where they'll actually tell you the exact words of the original language that Jesus used.
Yeah.
But not always. Why in these couple of moments will they give the original phrase?
Well, first of all, they're really dramatic moments. The Talitha Kumi is what he says, for example, Jairus' daughter. We just talked about her. Mm-hmm. Little girl, arise. That's in Aramaic. Mark quotes it in Aramaic, and Mark is for a pagan audience. They know so little about Jews that Mark has always had to explain what Jews do. So why would he quote Aramaic of all things to people?
Yeah.
And later on, Mark, for example, he talks about with the man whose ears are opened. He says, Ephatha, be opened. Again, Aramaic. Why would he quote when he's talking to pagans? Here's what I think is going on. In my generation, and I bet this, I'll give you an example from your generation. My generation, all of us, you could ask anyone, where were you when Kennedy was shot? There's no person my age who just can't tell you that moment.
Right.
Where were you here? My parents' generation, where were you at Pearl Harbor?
Okay.
When you got the news about
Pearl
Harbor.
For us, it's where are you at 9/11? Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Everyone has something like that. There are moments like this. Well, I knew this guy. This is interesting. The guy had his head open. They actually had what they call craniotomy. They removed part of his skull, take out a tumor. And they had his head all wrapped up, and you know, he's on all these drugs and things for the first day or so. And he tells people that, you know what, the thing he remembers out of all that, because in this just haze, he doesn't remember anything, because suddenly he remembered someone saying, squeezing his hand and saying, Brad is here. And that's the first thing he remembers, those exact words. It's the first thing he realized, he's back.
Hmm.
They had nothing, it's just that he had other visitors. The first thing, he said, the first thing I remember is my hand being squeezed, and someone said, Brad is here. It's the first thing I remember coming out of the operation, which was hours and hours later.
Yeah,
it's like that moment of authenticity, you know, that, you know, wow, it has that feeling of a real memory like that of something. So here, what do they remember? This is such a thing, seeing a dead person get up from the dead, that he still remembers the very words. It wasn't, he said to him something like, Talitha Kumi, he's exactly those words, and she got up.
Mm-hmm. So it's a point of...
It gets realistic when people have something like that, they'll remember details.
Okay.
Also, with Mark's gospel, Mark isn't one of the apostles. Mm-hmm. So the issue might, too, is we think that basically what he's doing is recounting Peter's stories. And
okay.
This might have helped Peter love to recount and say, you know, I can still remember the words Jesus said, the exact words. Mm. Talitha Kumi.
Interesting. Very
little
interesting.
Girl, get up.
So it's... it's adding credibility, but also to a very profound moment where those words would have had a great impact on the people involved.
Yeah, and all of us had that experience. We can think of deep moments in our lives, the things we'll remember.
Yeah.
The details that will come up, like when at a funeral with our parent or something we'll remember as a little child from that moment. We'll mm-hmm. remember some flower, some relative, some hug. And when a person grabs that moment, that gives you the sense, this is a real story.
Yeah.
This is a real memory, not third hand.
Uh-huh.
This is something from somebody who really was there.
Okay, so you talked also about details that answer objections that people might have had. Let's talk about those for a little bit.
First of all, there are a lot of issues with Jesus for someone who's just coming, especially before Christianity, you know, it becomes a world religion and things. It seems a strange group of people. One thing would be, well, let's talk about things that would lead to questions potentially about Jesus and about his resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
First one would be, you know, one of his intimate group became disillusioned.
Yeah.
So maybe he knew something about Jesus that we wouldn't be. Maybe, sometimes our idols have feet made of clay.
Okay.
So the Gospels go out of the way to emphasize that Judas did it for the money.
I see.
They give us his motive. Otherwise, we might think, was he simply disillusioned with Jesus, etc.? Did he know something we didn't know? But they all emphasize it was the money.
Okay.
He was in it for the money. Second thing is Pilate. You know, one of the things in the ancient world, the Roman justice system had a deserved good reputation. If you read Acts of the Apostles and things, the Romans always come out looking good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They would say, for example, they didn't believe in religious crimes that way. You know, when the people come and say,
right,
what did he do that was wrong?
Yeah,
that religious stuff. We're Romans.
Yeah. Okay.
We don't get into that. So look at, for example, let me read from an account here. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Nothing deserving of death has been done by him." What a testimony, because one of the things that really scandalized people in the ancient world is Jesus was a convicted criminal.
Yeah.
He was convicted.
Yeah.
Imagine if we had a leader for a pastor or something say, you realize the guy did time.
Yeah, yeah. And under a credible justice system.
Under a credible justice system.
Like, well, yeah.
You know, what do they know again?
Uh-huh.
And so they go out of their way to point out that the Romans, you know, and that's why they also explained them, why did he do it if he was innocent? They said a riot was breaking out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a careerist after all. Actually, his career later on is ruined by the fact that he just can't keep things together.
Right, right.
But he's worried the city had twice its normal population because of Passover, so it's really ripe for riots. A lot of people who don't live there especially like to riot and pillage.
And that is a moment where we start getting into a lot of detail about the movements of the crowd and of the attitude of Pilate and of the conversation. We zoom in a lot here. That's a good point.
And you see why it would be. Again, so somebody who here is just saying, this outlaw sect or something, say, wait a second. Look, the guy's a convicted criminal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the Romans agreed with that. Actually, the Romans didn't.
Yeah.
Pilate said, and Herod, the two actual people who were neutral, who didn't have it out for him, both said he was innocent. Then why did he hand him over? Well, they said it would because they just didn't want a riot. If somebody had to go, you know, they weren't going to risk a riot in the city with thousands and thousands of people just loosely around for the holidays.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
But with the resurrection, we have a lot of interesting things to sort of forego possible good questions.
Yeah, so there's a lot of questions like that still kind of floating around today, I think, by people who are skeptical. Like, what if they, you know, like, went to the wrong tomb? What if someone stole the body? What if it was all a fake? You know,
exactly.
So you're telling
me those are good questions.
So you're telling me the Gospels actually are addressing these?
Oh, yeah. For example, what we're told, it's again, rarely, details normally have meaning in the Gospel. That's why they're put in. They're not put there for color. We're told that Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joses, saw where he was laid. And Mary Magdalene is back the next day. So there's no question of, he was buried somewhere over there.
Got it.
They actually follow and see the tomb. And the very same person, Mary Magdalene, comes back the next day. So there's no question about the wrong tomb.
Okay, yeah.
That's why they mention the same person. That's the important thing, why it had to be Mary Magdalene.
Hmm.
She's the one who saw. The apostles had run off.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't in a possible position to see anything.
So that's, you know, where she becomes important.
She becomes very important. Yeah. She's the apostle. You know, she's the first one who sees the risen Lord.
Yeah.
But another thing that came up, again, with the burial, we emphasize the burial clothes are left behind. Well, if the story, as we're told in Matthew, came around that the apostles had just gone there that night and stole the body. Well, wait a second. If you're stealing something, you want to get out quickly. For example, if you're shoplifting, you don't take the stuff out of the box with the wrapping. What you do is you try to put the box under your coat or something.
Yeah,
you try to get out as fast as you possibly can without being noticed. Why in the world would you unwrap a dead body and leave the wrappings behind neatly? Wouldn't you just grab the body and go and do it somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason you would unwrap the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's something. It's not consistent with the story the body was stolen. Then why are the wrappers still there? There are other theological meanings, the fact that he's no longer bound by death. But a very practical meaning is, look, they were there. Everyone says, you know, that they're there lying in the tomb. Well, why would you unwrap the body if you're trying to escape with it without being caught?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
What's the advantage? Also, what about the fact, remember, one thing that we know is Jesus wasn't on the cross very long. Crucifixion took a long time because, as I think we've explained in the program, it's probably worth it again. Crucifixion, you die by suffocation.
Mm-hmm. It takes
a while. What you have to do is they put you in a pose where you have to push up again with your feet against the stake in order to get a breath. Every time you breathe, you have to push up.
Okay, yeah.
And what happens eventually is, imagine like there were a concentration camp, Mauthausen, that did this. It would simply have people walk until they died, knowing that you'll walk and you will live as long as you make a next step. This moment you don't make a next step, you'll get killed.
Uh-huh.
in the tortured, people who torture themselves. You know, they don't want this to be the last step.
Right.
But there gets to be a point you just can't go another step. That's how crucifixion worked. Is you push up and you get weaker and weaker and weaker, but you know, finally you couldn't breathe. It normally took a long time. It could take days. And that's why, because it's the Passover, they can't leave the bodies up, so they actually have to break the, like, why do they break the legs? Is because if you can't break the legs, you can't push up, so you suffocate immediately.
Right.
And the death was supposed to be crucifixion, meant suffocation.
Yeah.
In Jesus' case, people say, well, they said, and there's no denying it, everyone's seen this, Jesus' legs weren't broken, so the one possibility is maybe he didn't die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, maybe he just passed out and things, you know, et cetera. They got down the body, and he survived for a while. So John's gospel emphasizes the fact that he's stabbed through the heart. You know, okay. The lance goes through heart. And he said, we saw him. It wasn't just that blood and water coming out. I mean, he got him through the heart.
Right.
Blood
right.
and water comes out. And John emphasized, I saw with, you know, the he who saw these things is speaking the truth. They saw him. An eyewitness saw this. And that's why Thomas also is invited to put his hand in the side. The side is the vital thing. The hands and things, you know, because it's still him. But the side, he's dead. So otherwise, we might have asked, well, if he's only on there for a few hours, he might very well have survived.
Yeah.
So it removes that possible objection.
Huh. Wow. I hadn't thought about the blood and water part being almost like a forensic detail.
Yeah. But it's certainly as far as removing that possibility, well, maybe he wasn't dead. And again, no one's going to argue with the facts. People knew that his legs weren't broken.
Yeah.
There were people there.
Yeah.
A lot of people. Public executions were entertainment.
Yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of people around watching.
Now, tell me, there's another potential objection I've heard where, you know, it's like the body double objection. Like maybe, you know, there's like someone else who's impersonating Jesus or sort of looked like Jesus or something like that. And the apostles and everyone are just, you know, so desirous to believe that he rose from the dead that they just sort of believe.
Well, that's really important. Yeah. Thank you. We have a lot that deals with exactly that possibility. First of all, what might strike us as counterintuitive is that the witnesses to the resurrection are almost universally people who knew Jesus well.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible. Like you and I might go to a Rolling Stones concert to date myself or something. Have seen them once in a distance.
Stephen, I would love to go to a Rolling Stones concert with you. That's just like the pinnacle of a weekend. But anyway, we'll continue.
Well, but the point is, you could say, well, I've seen them. But seeing somebody on a stage for a few hours or something once hardly makes you an expert that this is them.
True.
Someone you've had lunch with and eat dinner with and, you know, and camp together with for several years, there's no getting around the fact that's them. There's unmistakable. Like Mary Magdalene, look at the way he pronounces my name. That's Jesus.
Okay.
That's how she recognized the gardener. Duh.
Yeah. So like you're saying that if Keith Richards had seen Mick Jagger risen from the dead, then you really, that adds some credibility to it. Yeah.
Well, I must honestly admit that's not the example I would have come up with, but it's the idea that somebody who really knew, that there's no question about this was really the person. There's no question this was really Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So an eyewitness or someone who, the eyewitness
a
is
a person in a position
that
there's no question of fooling them, that they don't know them well enough. It would come out. And also, Jesus spends a lot of time with them. People say, well, he's hanging around from Easter until, you know, the day of his ascension.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or they're the 40 days between them. And it says he's spending that time with them and things. So it's not like pulling it off. I mean, he's with them. These are people who live with him. It's obvious. Another thing that really helps is, again, we say, well, is this wishful thinking of people who really wanted Jesus back? The universal thing going across is that everybody is surprised. No one expects Jesus. Where is he? Where is Jesus? He said he'd rise.
Yeah.
To the contrary, you know, Mary Magdalene, the first witness, thinks it's just the gardener. The thought of Jesus doesn't enter her mind. Finally, she recognizes the voice and says, Master! You know, it's you. We have, you know, so the normal, you know, people are surprised. The disciples on the road to Emmaus are surprised. They don't say, oh, there he is. You know, they're with him. They walk with him, et cetera, in their case. But they're not expecting Jesus.
Okay.
You know what it can be like? Have you ever had a situation where there's somebody you know, but you see them this can happen. Let's say you're traveling in Europe or something. You're just on a vacation. What's the chances? But, you know, people go to the same spots.
So you see somebody you know.
You see somebody, but you think it can't be them because, you know, I'm in Berlin or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's not in the right context.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that's why with Emmaus, they sort of looks, but yeah, a lot of people, you know, who look like this, you know.
Right.
And they're just on a casual trip. They don't expect him to be alive. And so they assume, yeah.
It is true. When that happens, your first reaction is not utter credulity, but it's actually, I remember actually seeing there's a Dallas Mavericks basketball player from when I was a kid named Sean Bradley, and he mm-hmm. was 7 feet tall. And I once saw him in a mall, and objectively, there's no question that it's him. He's 7 feet and seven, but it still took me a full couple of minutes to actually, that really is him. You know?
Yeah.
But like, yeah, your first reaction isn't credulity; it's actually incredulity. It's like,
and nobody again, Thomas, when he hears this, when the apostles hear the stories from both the disciples and Emmaus come back and tell them, and Magdalene, they don't believe any of it.
Right.
Come
right.
on. This is too far. It's like those people, you know, someone, you have a death in the family, something like, oh, I remember just last week, and they just wanted to tell those stories.
Yeah.
So they said, I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
It's not like they're expecting.
I've moved on.
You know, it's just that you're wrecking it. You know, mm-hmm. come on, he's dead.
Yeah.
So that's the universal reaction. So it's saying rather than these people sitting around, and of course they believe it because they're sitting around waiting for risen Jesus. No, they aren't.
Yeah.
And finally, we would have, well, gee, you say, well, isn't the downside that they're all believers? You know, well, there's one notable exception. Paul. Saul had no reason to want to meet the risen Christ.
Sure.
But he actually does.
Quite the opposite.
He has quite the opposite. So we actually have one example of someone who is hostile. That Jesus appears to someone who is as hostile as can possibly be and turns them around.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they're trying to deal with those things that people say, well, gee, all your witnesses are people who love Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, saying, well, here's someone who certainly didn't love Jesus. He actually said he's involved with deaths of people who love Jesus.
Right.
So they're trying to cover, you know, the most obvious bases that would come up with the resurrection.
Wow. Okay. Oh, great. So the details in the Gospels and in the book of Acts are there to give you a sense of how you should be taking the events or the words of Jesus to head off some objections and to give credibility to what's going on.
That's one of their uses, right?
Okay. So that's very strategic deployment of literature, I have to say. Yeah,
they're very carefully written.
Yeah,
I mean, the Gospels are very, very carefully written.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else you'd say about to our listeners about details in the Gospels?
I think what it really takes some discipline. We're so used to the story sometimes it can, you know, to tell ourselves, let's read them as fresh as we can to go back and really think of every line, not just rush right through to the, you know, just think of the lines, go through, look what comes before, look what comes after.
Yeah.
And we sometimes discover things that we're just missing because they're hiding in plain sight.
Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have left for this episode, and thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.